Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
When you were 12 years old, you couldn't hit a curveball, so you decided you'd never be a Major League Baseball player, and shortly thereafter, you began studying to become an accountant. According to Matthew Side, you probably gave up your dream too quickly. In his new book, Bounce, subtitled Mozart, Federer, Picasso, Beckham, and the Science of Success, Side argues that what distinguishes the most accomplished athletes, artists, musicians, and other high achievers from the rest of us is not talent, but thousands and thousands of hours of precise and concentrated practice. When I had the opportunity to talk with Matthew Side recently, I began our conversation by weeping loudly at my own lost opportunities. No, I really began by asking him about his argument that talent is overrated.
Well, what is clear to me, and this is based on many years of experience as a table tennis player and since studying the science of success, is that there is no such thing as a shortcut. Every single person you see performing at an excellent world-class level in anything from basketball to tennis to music to business, they have spent a lot of time, astronomical amount of time, practicing. We all start out pretty ordinary. I was a two-time Olympic table tennis player, but I wasn't very good when I picked up a bat. But you become extraordinary through the transformational process of practice. You build new neural connections. The anatomy of the brain changes over time. Mm-hmm. And the inference, we often look at a fantastic performer, we think, I couldn't do that. Where is the evidence that you couldn't do it? The only way you can find out is by clocking up those hours. And all of the people who have clocked up those hours reach world-class level.
If it's thousands of hours of practice that led Roger Federer to become a champion tennis player and Bobby Fischer to become a superb chess player, to what extent does it follow that anybody who practices a sport or studies musical composition for 10,000 hours and more can reach the highest level of achievement in that discipline?
That's a terrific question. And the answer to it is based on very detailed science, mostly compiled by Anders Ericsson at Florida State University, who's done some wonderful cognitive psychology over many years. But he has dug down into the narrative histories of all those who have reached world-class level. So first of all, they have clocked up the 10,000 hours. But he's also looked at the counterfactual, those people who have clocked up 10,000 hours and failed to perform. But the thing is, there aren't any of those.
Well, or maybe they're just not talking. They're ashamed.
I guess it is conceivable that there is a level of hidden evidence out there. But those who have gone to look for it haven't found it. And what they have found, as I say, is a remarkable process of transformation. So even those who started out not very good, the ones that we might describe as untalented, the ones who would want to hide away, if they keep going, if they continue along this path, they eventually get there. I would just make one proviso. Of course, not everybody who's played the same amount of basketball as Jordan or the same amount of the piano as Mozart reached the same level as they do. All of us who are healthy can make it to the top. But whether you get to the pinnacle probably pivots on something else, but it isn't clear quite what that is. It may well be the psychology of performance. It may well be the way they practice that has conferred an advantage. But what does seem clear is most of us have the potential to become excellent.
One of the variables that came into play for you, and you were a champion table tennis player, a two-time Olympian, and one of the variables that came into play was where you happened to be born, where you grew up. How did that play into it?
Yeah, well, I grew up in a very anonymous suburban town and on a very anonymous suburban street. And looking around me at the top world-class table tennis players in the 1980s, almost all of them came from the very same street. There wasn't a genetic mutation that affected only that street and none of the surrounding areas, but what we did have was a brilliant coach, and we had access to the only 24-hour club. So we transformed ourselves over time, and we see this hotbed phenomenon in other areas. So, for example, Spartak Moscow, the tennis club, produced more top 20 women players than the whole of the United States, and that club is quite an impoverished club in the Russian capital. And these hotbeds don't develop because of a specific genotype that exists in those locations. It's because these people have had very unusual opportunities to become excellent.
Your own specific case notwithstanding, your book, Bounce, is not lacking in generalizations. You write about life as having two paths at one point, and I'm paraphrasing, one leads to mediocrity, the other to excellence. Tell me about what determines which path various people choose.
Well, if you agree with the thesis that all of us have the ability to become excellent in whatever domain of expertise, the question is, why is it that some people persist on the path? If we go back to the early part of our conversation, you said, are there some who persist on the path but don't get anywhere? I think it's unlikely that is the case. But why is it that some people persist? And I think there's two reasons. One, you have to care about the destination. Some people really care about becoming fantastic at basketball or becoming world class at the piano. And if you really care, of course, you're more likely to try and get towards the destination. But the problem, of course, is en route to the destination, every now and again you're going to fail. You're going to mess up. If you believe that you have the ability to adapt and to grow, you're not going to interpret failure as a reason to quit. If, on the other hand, you believe that achieving excellence hinges on your natural talent, every time you mess up, you're going to think, well, I must lack the talent. It is a generalization, but Carol Dweck, the professor of psychology at Stanford University, has classified different people as having a growth mindset and the others have a fixed mindset, and there is robust statistical evidence that the way these two mindsets respond to failure is fundamentally different.
As you acknowledge in Bounce, even some of the most thoroughly prepared athletes who've practiced well over 10,000 hours sometimes choke. You specify Greg Norman at the Masters in 1996 when he blew what looked like a sure victory over several very poorly played holes, and Bill Buckner, who missed a single ground ball during the 1986 World Series with terrible consequences. But can you really legitimately compare those two very different circumstances, one ground ball with, I don't know, half an hour's worth of poor golf shots?
Yeah, it's actually difficult to make an inference that they're both because of the same underlying psychological phenomenon. I think we can say with a certain degree of certainty that what happened to Greg Norman was what we call choking, where a world-class performer was suddenly unable to perform the skill he had spent a lifetime perfecting. And the neuroscience behind choking is now very well established. It is a curious and rather unusual phenomenon, but one now, I think, that is fully explainable.
Well, please explain.
Well, I think probably the best way to understand this weird phenomenon is when you begin in any task, so say, for example, driving a car, you exert conscious control in order to build up the neural framework supporting the skill. So, for example, you know, you're looking in the mirror, you're pressing on the gas, you're turning the steering wheel, and you're consciously monitoring what you are doing, so much so that it's actually difficult to perform all those various tasks simultaneously. But over time, you can delegate those motor skills to, as it were, implicit memory. You can do it automatically, subconsciously. The problem is when an expert performer who is able to execute something like a 5-iron to the green at a subconscious level becomes so anxious, he tries to consciously control it. He almost becomes a beginner again. That's why the expert performer slows down. You remember Novotna against Steffi Graf in the Wimbledon final. She was serving the ball halfway up the net. She couldn't get into position. She was trying to consciously organize these very complex tasks. And because of that, it became stilted and sluggish. And that's when you have this catastrophic decline in performance. And so the best way is just to do it. I mean, the Nike commercial actually pithily summarizes it.
You just got to, for that reason.
You know what I mean? You just got to go. You just got to go and do it.
How do you relate your theories about how athletes achieve success to such stereotypes, some of which you bring up at the end of your book, such stereotypes as Kenyans are naturally great marathoners and white men can't jump?
Yeah, it's a very interesting one, and actually a kind of a politically explosive issue. But often we will see a group of people doing well at something. So as the example you take, Kenyans running terrifically well at 5,000 meters above, and we'll say blacks must be better distance runners. It turns out it's not Kenyans who are good at distance running. It is a very small geographical population in the Western Rift Valley in and around a town called Eldoret. And it is just this very small subsection, with most of Africa actually underrepresented. And a Scottish academic, Yanis Pitsiladis, has actually taken cheek swabs from the top Kenyan and other distance runners to examine the DNA under a microscope. And he's the only one who's actually bothered to go out and check the genetic evidence. And he has found that there is no genetic mutation that explains the success of the Kenyan runners. Instead, he has found that what they tend to have in common is living a very long way from school, with school at altitude. And so over time, running, I mean, sometimes they're running upwards of 20 kilometres a day. They've built an aerobic capacity. So again, it comes back to the culture and the environment and not the genotype.
Your position on performance-enhancing drugs, as expressed in Bounce, in your book, seems to be that athletes, like the rest of us, should have complete access to any drug that can enhance our lives in any way, as long as they and we don't abuse that drug to the extent that it harms us. Have I got that about right?
You've got it absolutely brilliantly, actually, but that's a perfect summary of what I feel, is that if you want to take something and it isn't damaging to your health, and it's not going to be damaging to your fellow competitors, seems to me that there's no moral or ethical reason to ban that particular technology. The reason, of course, that people in sport want to take drugs is in order to compete more effectively. So, for example, if I take a drug and you don't take it, and I come ahead of you in a race, I've gained, but at your expense. But I want to just draw a contrast here. Imagine there was some kind of an enhancement technology that could help me beyond sport. Let's say, for example, a genetic enhancement that engineered immunity to the cold. I would want to take advantage of that technology, but I would want you to benefit from it too, Bill. The enhancement outside sport is what economists call a zero-sum game. If I win, you lose. But the enhancements that we can get access to outside sport, better health, longer lives, and so on, I think we should grasp those genetic and biological enhancements with both hands. And I fear very much that the prevailing attitude around the world is one of fear when it comes to genetic enhancement.
When we apply your theory to sports, is there a performance-enhancing drug that doesn't do damage? Because what's sure to come to people's minds is roid rage from steroids, EPO clogging up arteries so badly that cyclists in the Tour de France suffer heart attacks, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I think you've identified pretty much the two major areas of drug enhancement, steroids and muscle building on the one hand, and EPO, or increasing the number of red blood cells to improve endurance, on the other. But let's just take the example of EPO, or blood doping, or anything that increases the number of red blood cells. The reason it's dangerous, as you suggest, is that the blood becomes thicker, and it's more onerous for the heart to pump it around the body. But imagine you took a bit of EPO that increased the level of red blood cells, what's called the hematocrit level, from 40% to 45%. There's no real danger associated with that. It's only when you start getting above 60% that the thickness of the blood creates the potential for a heart attack. So what I'm saying is feel free to increase the red blood count to a legal limit, which you could be set by experienced doctors. But why ban people from increasing the level of red blood cells in a way that is safe? It's like, for example, banning someone from going altitude training. That increases the number of red blood cells in precisely the same way, but we don't ban it.
Matthew, you don't limit your theory that one gains expertise through a great deal of practice to athletes and artists, where perhaps their achievements are more measurable. You talk about business people and physicians as well, and how they might be better trained according to that theory of the science of success. Tell me a little more about that.
Well, I guess one thing, it's a really interesting point, because some of us will be in a job for 10, 15, 20 years without any noticeable improvement. My mother was a secretary, and she typed at 70 words a minute after some training, and she plateaued at that level for the rest of her life. And the reason is because she was pretty satisfied with where she had got to, and she didn't challenge herself to build up additional speed. But what we do know is when typists have been put through extra training, so they train in the way that sportsmen and women train, extending their existing limitations, seeking out advantage, they get up to 80, 90, 100, 140 words a minute, which is an astronomical improvement. And what I argue is that if you continue to challenge yourself to try and build expertise over time, the improvements over time can be very dramatic.
It might be a good thing, unless the people got better at developing even more complicated instruments to bundle up bad mortgages and sell them to us.
You know, it's such a good point. And it's the same, actually, in the criminal underworld. You'll have people practicing at being better criminals and getting better and better at it. I hope very much that the theory I describe will be used by people in the right way.
Matthew Seid, a BBC commentator and columnist for The Times of London, is the author of Bounce, Mozart, Federer, Picasso, Beckham, and The Science of Success, published by Harper. The author joined me from the BBC in London. Matthew, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks for having me on. I've really enjoyed it.
My conversation with Matthew Seid will be featured on this week's show. I'll also be talking with Sports Illustrated writer David Epstein, who's found, in the context of the National Hockey League, a case study demonstrating how not to respond to the possibility that performance-enhancing drugs may have infiltrated your business. Only a Game's Doug Trabu will have a story about kendo, a sport that, like hockey and baseball, requires wooden sticks, but, curiously, lacks a ball or a puck. We'll also have a story about how the National Football League tests the intelligence of their wannabes, and I'll be updating the NFL draft and the NHL and NBA playoffs as well. So join us, and remember, you can always hear the program at onlyagame.org.